Today on Sticks In, we take a look at the results from the first weekend of college lacrosse, which was about as good as anyone could ask for. No Tuesday top 20, as the first poll update doesn't happen until next week, but we'll still look at scores and what stood out. Plus, I attended the New England Youth Lacrosse Convention on Sunday at Gillette Stadium, heard from some great speakers, learned a ton. So I had some takeaways from that that we're going to go into related to the PLL, to college, to lacrosse, just in general. All that and more. If you're enjoying the podcast, please do leave a like, subscribe, rating, thumbs up, download, whatever it is your platform of choice allows you to do. Thank you for coming back. Let's do it. Welcome back to Sticks In. My name is Dan Arestia. College lacrosse season has arrived. It has arrived with a bang. This is week zero, or I don't know, maybe week one. I don't know, whichever you prefer to call it. It's opening weekend. Games that matter were played. It was not one of those opening college football weekends where everybody kind of plays a tune-up game and the contenders beat up on a lower team. There were matchups between contenders on the calendar right out of the gate, and I love that. I love teams challenging themselves early. It means maybe they take an early loss or two. They maybe even fall out of the top 20 early. Who knows? But they get to be battle-hardened and better for it come late March and April. So I love the teams that load up with the tough opponents right out of the gate. Short-term loss maybe, but long-term gain. Definitely long-term gain for it, that whole thing. There's no new poll this week. The top 20, the media poll doesn't get updated after this week because not enough teams really have played for there to be like movement within it, I think, that's really meaningful. So the poll will get adjusted. The media will vote next weekend, and we'll get back to regular Tuesday top 20 after that happens. But we can still just kind of work through some of the games, some of the results over the weekend with a couple of those kind of quick hits. High Point beat Mercer 14-7. Part of me still believes that the Bears, that it's a program that's on the right track, but High Point's offense is just too good, I think. Maia had four goals. I think Van Overbeek actually had a pretty bad shooting day, and it didn't even really matter all that much. Mercer's Colin Kelly made 16 saves, and that still just wasn't enough. So Mercer got to play again literally the next day, and they beat up on Hampton in the quick turnaround, so they sit at 1-1. The Panthers, though, it's that game that everybody loves every year. High Point Panthers have their February Duke game next weekend. That'll be fun. Speaking of the Devils, Duke beat Bellarmine 20-12. Bellarmine plus 12, in my opinion, was easy money. They are not pushovers. Giving up 20 to Duke doesn't make somebody a pushover. Duke will put up scary goal totals on a lot of teams that are better than Bellarmine, that are better than a lot of people over the course of the season, because Duke's just that good. J.C. Higginbotham made 18 saves for Bellarmine. Jeez. And Duke still had 20. That's what they bring to the table. What the Duke offense brings to the table. So Brennan was Brennan. 7 points. He didn't lead scorers in the game, though. Josh Sawada did. Michigan transfer looked immediately comfortable. Had really, really good chemistry with Brennan O'Neill at attack. Meso went 78% facing off. Obviously, that's going to help things. If this offense plays make it, take it, you're not going to win the game. It really is that absolute. It's that scary. So Devils were the comfortable opener. Next, we had Cleveland State beat VMI 12-11 in overtime. A little bit of a battle back, I think, too, for the Vikings to have to get the win in this one. But VMI was getting 4.5 or even 5 goals, maybe. That was one where I thought that was easy money. The Keydets have a way of keeping games like this a scrap, keeping them a battle. So I was not surprised to see them hang tough. Colgate beat Penn State 13-12. I think this is the most talked about results of the weekend, right? I think it has to be, despite some of the other endings that were out there. I think this is the one that really raised the most eyebrows, moved the most needles. Number 4, Penn State going down at home to Colgate, who nobody expected anything of this season. This is a game, Penn State was a nearly 10-goal favorite. They were minus 15,000 on the money line. That is overwhelming. And they lost. A true stunner. Game was decided in the final seconds. Penn State threw just a brutally bad pass from an out-of-bounds play into the middle of the field, like right to a Colgate defender. That gets picked off, moved up the field, ends up with Liam O'Connor, a freshman, scores his first career goal to give Colgate the lead with 4 seconds left. And that ultimately was the game winner. TJ Malone, 7 assists. Kyle Lehman had a hat trick. He looked good in his debut for Penn State. But Frassian went 35% on the day. That's tough. That's tough. He's got to be better than that. Colgate, look, assuredly is going to crack the top 20. Despite the fact that at present, Cuse is, as I'm recording this, Cuse is approaching 20 goals. We'll see if they make it there. But Cuse is found a rhythm and is running it up a little bit. But I still think even if Colgate gets beaten pretty soundly here by the Orange, I will probably still have them in the top 20 next week off the strength of a win against Penn State. Unless maybe Penn State loses. If Penn State loses again next week, it's chaos, and it's mid-February. The next game we have Denver over Hopkins, 13-12, another overtime. This is probably the second most talked about result of the weekend. Denver was down in the fourth, went on an insane run to close this game. J.J. Shilstrop at the center of it all, scoring the game's last 4 goals, including one with 2 seconds left in regulation. Where it was funny, as it happened, you know, Denver's running a play to try and get a good look at goal. A Hopkins defender basically blows up a picker and gets hit with a 2-minute non-releasable blow to the head penalty. But I'm like, well, who cares? There's 2 seconds on the clock. You could make the penalty for 3 days. It doesn't matter. This game's going to be over. And then Denver executes basically the best thing you could possibly do with that little time left. They screen the goalie. They get the ball to their best shooter, who's Silstrop, and he fires it at the feet of all these guys standing in front of the goal that are screening Chase Erlin, and the ball skips in. It's a miracle that it happens, but if you're going to try and do it, it's your best chance to do it. And Denver executed it well. And so that penalty ended up mattering because then Denver gets like a minute and 50 of man up time locked in to start overtime. Not that the locked in matters anymore, but, you know, the 2 minutes of man up in overtime. So they're able to, Hopkins actually got the ball first, but Denver's able to, you know, Hopkins is only able to kind of try and kill penalty time. They're a man down, so they can't really do much. Denver gets the ball back after a shot clock runs out. And from there, they get the ball back to Silstrop on a nice little rotation where they just kind of moved faster than the Hopkins man down defense was getting to JJ. And he rips it from a low angle, low to high, and wins the game. So Hop didn't really in this one. It's tough to find a player who had a better weekend than JJ Silstrop, by the way. He had the buzzer beater to send it to OT, the game winner, and one of the goals of the weekend with a one-handed wraparound diving goal from Max. He was electric. But I didn't think as the game went on, even though they kind of got outscored and they had this lead late, I didn't think Hopkins was taking their foot off the gas too early or anything like that. I think Denver's defense is plenty good, and it wasn't surprising to me to see them kind of limit Hopkins down the stretch. The Jays are still a very experienced group on offense. They were getting decent looks. It was just one of those kind of games, I think, where they couldn't get anything to fall against a good defense. Hunter Chevette had a nice introduction to the college lax world with a hat trick, including a low angle missile. He shoots the hell out of the ball. He is fun to watch every week. And I thought Logan Callahan played really well up against Stathicus at the faceoff spot. I think they went pretty close to 50-50. So I think Hop's going to be fine, but the top 20, again, is going to be shuffling. Navy beat Mount St. Mary's 19-6. Navy got off to kind of a bad shooting start in this one, but when they started kind of seeing them fall, and then they eventually just kind of got rolling and ran away with it. I think the Navy defense is going to be excellent. Bonnet's actually had 2 points this game. A.J. Marsh has played up to the billing early here through one game and through the fall and all that. He has been about as good as any defenseman you could expect as a freshman. Xavier Arline with a hat trick. The Mount is not an offensive juggernaut by any means, but I really do think the Navy defense is going to cause people problems. Ohio State beat Utah 11-8. This was one of my more kind of intriguing games of the weekend, I think. Utah got out to a fast start, as you'd expect. They took an early lead. They're a team that's going to want to play fast. They're going to want to try and track meet you with you a little bit. But eventually that Ohio State defense did clamp down. Hudgens, Brown, BVB, all excellent. The short stick D middies were really, really good. Tommy Burke went over 60% facing off. I think that's really Ohio State's formula. And, you know, the offense will probably get better as the year goes on, as they kind of find a way to gel a little bit. Look, they got 5 goals from a transfer in Gannon Matthews. Of their 7 point scorers, 5 of them were guys who came from the portal, as I looked at it, I think. You had Kurt Brunn, you had Matthews, you had McKenna with a goal. Greenblatt was in the score sheet. So it's if your offense is all portal guys coming from different schools, it's hard to be fully cohesive week 1. Yeah. So for Utah, that offense, to me, I still trust it plenty. I started saying it at the end of last year. I will continue to say it as this year goes on. Get yourself as much Ryan Stein stock as you can. That kid's going to be a star, man. He had some highlight plays, had a hat trick. He is a really, really good player for Utah. Merrimack beat Bucknell 14-10. I thought Bucknell had a chance in this one. I kind of like them in it. I think Dutch Furlong is a really nice player, but the Mac, I think, just kind of pulled away late. Bison are kind of a frisky team, but, you know, we'll see. The Mac has a nice schedule, I think. They could get out to a good start. Loyola beat Georgetown 18-10. How about them Hounds? Nobody was really giving Loyola much of a chance or giving them maybe enough credit. There were probably a couple people out there picking Loyola, but I think Loyola just was a team with some question marks. Georgetown was a tough team for me to get a read on, admittedly. I ultimately just really liked them in the midfield. I think their midfield's really good, and I had big questions about Loyola's defense. And the Hounds held Graham Bundy completely scoreless, totally off the score sheet, and held Alex Verdaro to 1-for-8 shooting. That's really good. So there's your questions about the Loyola defense getting answered. The Loyola attack of James, Patra, and Minicus had 13 goals on 18 shots. If a team's attack is doing that to you, then it's going to be a long day. Remy Reynolds is a Rutgers transfer who looked very good on that Loyola defense. That he went a long way to answering some questions. Look, I don't think Georgetown's going to have too many games this year where Bundy doesn't have a point. I think they're going to be fine. But Loyola, again, they started last year with a bang. They're starting this year with a bang. They're saying you better notice us and you better respect us with a nice early win against the Hoyas. They get Maryland next week. Another chance for a big win. Hofstra beat Wagner 21-9. Not a lot to say here. Rory Jones had 8 goals, which I think might have been a record for somebody at some level. I don't know if it was a Hofstra record or CAA record or something, but I feel like I saw something that was maybe a record-setting performance. I like this Hofstra team. I like them to push towards the top of the CAA. I think, obviously, this wasn't a major test. They have Navy coming up. That's a major test, but I like Hofstra's talent. I really do, especially on the offensive end. I think they can be really, really good. Rutgers beat Lehigh 14-12. Rutgers was a 4-5 goal favorite, 4.5, 5 goals, something like that favorite in this one. And that definitely felt like way too much to me. I think Lehigh is adjusting, obviously, to life without Sisselberger, without Kevin Cassis in the sideline as Will Scudder takes over. But it's not like that, like, overnight turns them into some team that can't beat anybody. They still have plenty of offensive weapons that are really good. Scott Cole's a PLL player. But look, Rutgers went out and got themselves a good faceoff guy in Cole Brahms. And goalie play maybe wasn't great, but look, Rutgers got at least 2 goals from 5 different players. And when you got Ross Scott and Shane Knobloch and, you know, other guys that are sharing the rock that way, that are all involved that way, that's a recipe for success. So that's a welcome sight for them. Maryland beat Richmond 12-11, took 2 overtimes to settle this one. I thought Maryland would win this one a little more comfortably, not because I thought Richmond wasn't good. I ranked Richmond. I think they're a good team. I think they'll beat a lot of teams this year. But I didn't know – I didn't trust the Spiders to have the depth of scoring to consistently give the Maryland defense problems, because I rate the Maryland defense pretty well. But look, 8 different goal scorers in this one for Richmond on 11 goals. That's eye-opening. That's a depth of scoring. So Maryland's defense did hold Madonna and Young to a combined 4 goals. So you'd think that would do the trick, but Richmond had opportunities to win the game in overtime. Richmond was able to find the goals that they needed. Terps got a goal from 9 different players. They'll share the scoring all year, I think. Zapatello even had a goal in this one. So the Terps are going to be good. They're going to win the games they're meant to win. They will always have a guy who can provide the answer they need. They're always going to be prepared. They're going to be just well-positioned to win every game because they're so talented and they're so well-coached. So even whether it's a 12-11 double OT win over Richmond, and then, you know, next week they'll go out and play a top-5 team and win by 6 goals. That's just Maryland will have the answer every week. Marquette beat Air Force 12-6. Marquette with a really solid win, I think, on the road. That's going out to Colorado Springs. That's not that necessarily an easy trip in early February. So Air Force has some nice players. I think it's just I need to see that offense get used to playing without Brandon Dodd being the go-to guy who's been such a leader for them, particularly against a Marquette defense that's very well built, has maybe the top defenseman in the country, one of for sure, and Mason Woodward. 3 players with a hat trick for the Golden Eagles. Devin Cowan, I think, is the clear alpha there for them on offense. But I remain high on Marquette. I will continue to remain high on Marquette. NJIT beat St. John's 10-8. I threw this one on for a little while. Tuned in for this one a little bit. NJIT was a 4-goal underdog in this one, which is, I mean, 4 goals spread either direction in this game felt big to me, but they went outright. The Johnnies had their chances, and NJIT failed on 10 clears and had 25-plus turnovers in this game. That should lose you a game. So St. John's should be frustrated with themselves, frankly, that they weren't able to punish that amount of failure in the clearing game and turnovers. But NJIT holds on. Credit to them. I think a lot of that is thanks to Liam Brown, who made 20 saves, was 71% in net for NJIT. So a great performance from their netminder as they get a win over the Johnnies. Q's beat Vermont 20-7. A little slow start, but once they were comfortable, Q's was cooking. Like the early turnovers were not pretty, as they looked like they were just trying to play too fast and just not in control. And then it felt like the whole dome just took a deep breath and got on the same page, and it was good. 13 of their 20 goals assisted. I'll continue to say I think that has to be the formula for Q's. You know, if they start losing games, it's going to be games where it's like, all right, they scored 12 and had 4 assists or something like that. Games where they don't get assisted goals means Stars may be calling their own number too much and it's not getting shared. And when you have a team that's that loaded with players, I feel like that's always a risk. But I didn't see anything like that in this one. For all their firepower, the guy who really stood out to me and stands out as I watch this game with Colgate here is Billy Dwan. I mean, he's in passing lanes. He is in his man's gloves the second they receive a pass. He ran transition. He scored a goal against UVM. He's just flat out disruptive. He's just a thorn in the side of the offense all the time. He's always doing something to disrupt what the offense wants to do. The defenseman that bothers every little thing you try to do is going to be, he's going to stand out in games as Dwan is, but it's my favorite kind of pull to watch because they're always super active and they're just in the way, always disruptive. I loved watching him play in that UVM game. Stony Brook beat Sacred Heart 17-14. There's a shootout, right? That's a fun one. That one was the first Sunday game. Sacred Heart, or, you know, one of, I guess, a couple. I don't know if it was actually played first, but a Sunday game. Sacred Heart had a lead in this one. They traded some nice runs. Palinetti is special, had a hat trick. Nick Dupuy, I think, led the Seawolves in scoring, though. Sacred Heart returned a lot of firepower from last year. They have some really good defensemen. They have some pieces that I think they can be in the mix come conference tournament time. If they can kind of get comfortable and they can obviously, you know, Stony Brook, I think, is going to score goals on people because they're good. With Palinetti and Armitage and obviously Dupuy had the day he had, they're gonna put up some goal totals. But Sacred Heart is no slouch. Mercer beat Hampton 20-5. So Hampton drops their opener. And now they get, I think, some time off before they play Lafayette. They have a tougher schedule this year. I'm going to be pulling for them to try and win a game in 2024. If they play a game near me, I got to go back and look at their schedule. But if they play near me, I'm going to try and get to it. I know they're, you know, they have Fairfield on the schedule. If their Fairfield game is here, I will try and go. But I always try and go see a Hampton game when I can and try and support that program. Providence beat Holy Cross 12-6. Holy Cross offense was not good last year. It did not look good in this one. Providence still has Ryan Bell. He's one of the best offensive players in the Big East. This one felt pretty comfortable for the Friars, even more comfortable than 12-6. So it looks like Q's and Colgate have gone final. The Q's win there 18-10. And that was an 8-goal spread, so that's a push, I think. I think that went off at +8 for Colgate. So that, a little push is unfortunate, but the game kind of got robbed of some of its rhythm and some of its up and down and some of its pace for a while in the middle quarters because just so many penalties. I think Colgate had 10. Syracuse, I think, had 7 or 8, maybe. But that's a lot of penalties. And look, if you're Colgate, if you foul Syracuse 10 times, you're going to lose. I don't care who you are. If Q's goes on the man up 10 times in a game, you're going to lose. But, you know, Syracuse, you foul somebody 7 times. You know, when you get in an ACC play, you foul UVA 7 times, you're losing. They'll score on 5 of them. You're giving goals away. And Q's has had a pretty good penalty total, and now their first two games, they need to play cleaner. They play with an edge. They play, and you know, they you can tell they're out there, and they've got some things to say, and you don't ever want to take that away from them because it's part of their identity. It's part of who they are, and it's part of why they play, how they play, and you don't want to take their personality away. But when the team is also kind of on the younger side, you need to make sure that in moments where you need to not take a penalty, you don't take a penalty because one of your young guys just goes a little past the line with talk or with stuff after the whistle or anything like that. So I think for Q's right now, the focus is look, both ends of the field look great. Mason Cohen has looked very, very good facing off for them. It's tough to point to a spot where you really want Q's to clean it up, but the penalties is the Achilles heel for me for them through two games. Need to stay out of the box because they're going to start playing better teams. They play Manhattan next, but then they're into some tougher squads. When they play Army, you don't want to play the sloppy game against Army because they'll play clean and they'll win. So like I said, normally we kind of do this interwoven with the top 20. We'll go through my poll and we'll talk about the results as we go past teams. But again, new poll won't come out till next week. I'm still probably going to rank Colgate even after this 18-10 loss to Q's. I'll probably put them 19-20, maybe something like that, or find a spot for them in the high teens because I do really still rate the Penn State win that well. Utah's probably going to drop out. Ohio State's probably going to come in. Question is I think kind of as of today is how far is Penn State going to fall? How far are you going to move Denver up? And all that I think kind of depends obviously on what happens next week. If I was doing it today, I'm probably putting Penn State outside the 10 and the teens somewhere. Denver's probably in the 7-9 neighborhood ahead of Hop. But it'll be a big shift in the poll for 1 week, especially if next week we get even more of this. You know, everybody else is playing this weekend. If we see a bunch more upsets or some other big numbers go down, the poll's going to be a disaster, to be honest. It's going to be all over the place. But that's the college slate, man. That was the first weekend. It's something else I did want to talk through today because I had honestly a lot of fun going to it. I'm happy Kyle Devitt convinced me to go, and I'm happy he dragged me out of my house to do it. The New England Youth Lacrosse Convention was at Gillette Stadium on Sunday. And I, again, sort of last minute, Devitt was like, you should come do it. It's really cool. He's good coaches. You'll meet some people. It'll be fun. So I went. Kevin Barney was great and helping me out with helped me get a ticket and get all set up and everything there. So it was a great setup. It was in like the club level. We entered through that new lighthouse at Gillette, which was very cool. But there was, you know, vendors and a ton of different speakers and panels and opportunities to learn and all that. So I was excited about it. There were a few that I saw that I wanted to touch on in particular that I really took a lot away from when it comes to youth lacrosse, to college lacrosse, to pro lacrosse. You know, there was a lot of good stuff. Martin Bowes was the first person I saw, Marty Bowes. He was talking about player evaluation and development. If you don't know Marty, he played for the Cannons. I'm going to say for like a decade. He had a long career with the Cannons and the pros. He went through some drills that he does coaching with younger players. There were a few that I think would work for like my kids who are kindergartners. And if you have something that I think would work with that age group, I'm pumped because there's almost nothing you can do with a kindergartner playing lacrosse. But what stood out to me about his talk, and it was something, it was because the first thing I saw was at whatever, 9 in the morning. First thing I saw, but it was really became this thing that I followed as a thread through the day as I heard more coaches, was the focus on just play for kids of all youth ages, really. Finding this space between structured and I call it chaos, I guess, and just letting kids play the game. I heard coaches talking all day. I'm talking, including guys like, you know, Matt Strebel's there. He's a Hall of Famer. He coaches a trilogy. And he's talking about just letting the kids have fun, especially for a new player. If they, look, the fun part of lacrosse is shooting and seeing the ball go in the net. Don't be afraid to just go right to that. Start right at that with the new kid. Go out there and shoot the ball and see it go in the net and have some fun. You know, I was getting those lessons and hearing kind of that perspective from those guys. And I was thinking a lot as I listened about the number of sports in the United States that have become very rigid and programmed and formulaic. And soccer, I think, is the best example, because you have these young players who it's like, all right, you go play on this club team and this program and you do it this way. And you learn this exact specific way to play, and you don't just have fun and improvise and just get out there and roll the ball out and have a good time, play a game. And at higher levels, you see that come through as a disadvantage because they just know this way of doing things, this way that they've been coached and programmed by their club and U.S. soccer or whatever other sport you want to take a shot at here. And that's the way they do it. And they can't do anything else. And I think you can see that coaches, high-level coaches, even at the youth level, do not want that to happen with lacrosse. So you really heard this focus on let the kids just play and have fun. Don't worry about having like this drill set up and they're, you know, all that kind of stuff. Just let them play. The second thing that I went to that I saw was there was a panel discussion on diversity within lacrosse, which I always find to be valuable. Tyrone Croom, Tari Candamari, who you know is official Lax Girl on social, I'm sure. There were some speakers from Harlem Lacrosse that were part of it. I was very happy to be in the room for it. The discussion wasn't just like rehashing of the known issues that lacrosse has with diversity. We know what they are. But what I took away from it that I thought was really interesting was the way, a discussion sort of about the way we talk about players of color when we evaluate, when we watch, when we coach. The way, you know, you often hear it, you know, there's obviously the trope that we all know of where, you know, you see the young black player who's got great highlights, he's got great film, you see gameplay and all this stuff, and he's on both ends of the field, he's scoring on offense, he's playing good defense, he's doing everything well, and you always see it, well, he's probably going to pan out to be a short stick D-middy at the next level. Like, that's just something that always kind of happens. Or we say, well, he's a great athlete. He's just a great athlete. Man, he's what an athlete, special athlete. But we don't praise often when it comes to players of color, the lacrosse IQ, the hard work. That's usually what we say about players who look differently. So even saying something like, oh, he's a beast, he's a stud, for players of color, they might not always find that to be complimentary. And it's better to just describe what they do well, the way they play, the things they bring to the field, the skills that they have that make them stand out. As someone who talks and writes and comments about lacrosse a lot, it definitely had me looking inward to try and be more mindful of language I use to describe lacrosse players. It's just something I didn't really consider that much. So I was very grateful to be there and listen to that. The next thing I saw, the Thompsons were there. Jeremy and Jerome were there to talk about culture, history, and creativity in lacrosse, obviously through the perspective of Indigenous people and Indigenous lacrosse players. There was a particularly interesting moment in this one to me that I carried with me for the rest of the day. They had Q&A. And obviously some hands go up. Who wouldn't want to ask these guys questions about lacrosse? Jeremy got really excited to call on somebody because it was a kid in the crowd. He was lit like, yes, a young guy, you, I want your question. Jeremy is getting into coaching now, and you can see how excited he is to talk to and to coach and to be around kids like that. So the question was, what is your favorite version of lacrosse? And you know, there's a lot of ways you can answer that. But Ina thought about it for a little while and said to him, it's still the medicine game that they play at home. They play the once a year. You're talking hundreds of players from kids to guys in their prime, like, you know, like Jeremy and Hina, and then older people in the community, all still playing together. The space used, as he described it, is not massive. He said, you know, not much bigger than you might play on a field lacrosse game, but 100 players in that kind of space. And he talked about, even in his younger years as a young kid, getting out there to play and maybe never touching the ball once. But he recalled getting the ball for the first time when he was in high school, picking it up and running up the field with it, and the way it made him feel to be part of that game and to be that involved and everything. And like, as he told it, you couldn't help but just like smile, and you could feel the joy he must have felt as he told this story about first, you know, getting the ball and really being into the giant medicine game. The way he talked about how that fosters a growth in creativity and in fun. And, you know, you think about the spectacular handles, the behind the backs, all that stuff you see from Indigenous players in the field in the box game. And sometimes it's talked about like it's showing off or they're just making highlights. And it's honestly, it's the result of this game forcing them really to find ways to get the ball to teammates when they don't have a free hand. And there's like, forget having two defenders in the way, there's 10 defenders in the way. And you've got to thread a needle a certain way. You've got to throw the ball or do a certain thing with your stick to make the correct play in a lacrosse game. And the way that creativity stems from that is, it's like, it's unparalleled. So that was a very interesting thing to hear about from the Thompsons. I went to hear Pete Lasagna speak. If you don't know him, he was the OC at Brown. He was the head coach at Bates. Those are the places you would probably know him most from. His offenses were the ones you saw putting up just comically high goal numbers all the time. When you talk about playing fast, you know, he's the guy you want to talk to about it. But and you think about the idea of playing fast, usually the discussion focuses on how do you create transition? How do you apply pressure with passes that come off the ground, that kind of thing. Lasagna talked about coaching players to understand situations a little bit differently, not necessarily something that I had thought of all that often. Thinking instead of, you know, forgetting the how do we create transition, how do we do that, but when you're moving the ball up the field, if you're carrying the ball, reading a situation and diagnosing just, is my guy ready to defend me? Is this guy in front of me ready to guard me? Is he ready to stop me if I dodge right now? Or is he kind of backpedaling? Maybe he's not quite set. Is he anticipating that I'm going to dodge? If he's not, it's probably a good time to dodge. And a secondary read to that is this defender behind him ready to help? Does the slide guy look like he's in position? Does he look like he's too far away? He won't get to me in time if I beat this guy. And thinking of it that way, Coach Lasagna showed some tape about what he was talking about and illustrated this fact by showing goals that his teams had scored, maybe in situations where it was like a 1-on-5. Because the ball carrier is coming up the field, there's no numbers. He's ahead of the play, and there's a close defense that's ready, and you know there's nobody else there. But he understands this guy in front of me is not ready to guard me, and he runs by him, and he knows the help guy is not in a place to help. So he runs by his man, and he scores. 1-on-5, 1-on-4, those kind of situations. And some of these are happening, they're 7 seconds into a shot clock with a numbers disadvantage. So you see those, and it was fascinating. And the reason that I found it so interesting was I wanted to talk to him, and I did talk to him for a while about this afterwards, about that mindset and making those reads, but particularly in sixes. And he said, you know, we were talking, he's saying that format is great as a teaching tool for this kind of thing. So we talked for like a good 10-15 minutes about situations and that, the way that kind of that sixes format can apply to the larger field game, what you can take from there in terms of understanding, all right, I can attack, but in sixes it's different. I shouldn't take this shot because if I miss, we don't get the ball, but I can look up for trailers behind me because there's so many guys trailing a play. You know, we talked for a while about kind of the way this idea, the way this concept works in a sixes format, because that's how it really stood out to me. It was one of the highlights of my day for sure. And then finally, I wanted to say I saw Coach Holman, Brian Holman, a few times. He had one speech or one talk that was just him, and then one where he was on a panel with Jerry Byrne from Harvard and Matt Strebel, again, who I said coaches a trilogy. But his first one was just him, and I got to talk to him for a few minutes, just us kind of speaking a little bit. before he started. And I'm always grateful for every conversation I have with Coach Holman because he's such a wonderful guy who's got always nuggets of wisdom for you. But as he was talking about his philosophy, and his talk was on building championship culture, he basically didn't talk about actual lacrosse really at all, which if you saw him in the PLL or you saw any of his pressers last year, that probably comes as no surprise. But what I really liked kind of that he did was as sort of a thread throughout his talk, he's very much talking about culture building and, you know, developing young men to play and have goals together and, you know, to act a certain way and to hold each other accountable a certain way and those kind of things to build culture. But he really was introducing people in the audience to the Boston Cannons because the PLL team, that's now their home club. We're at Gillette Stadium and he's, you know, this is what you can expect from the Cannons are kind of things he was saying. He was promising the audience in his opening, you're going to be proud of the Cannons. This is their identity. This is our identity. This is what we're all about. Talked about the kind of team that they set out to be, what their foundational pillars are. It's an excellent way to deliver this culture building message that was the topic of the talk, but he's also got a captive audience that's all New England youth coaches, club directors, local programs, you know, local kind of businesses that are launching in the lacrosse space just in New England. And they're all there. It's a captive audience. And he was saying to them, we want to get to know you. We, the Cannons, the Boston Cannons, want to get to know and connect with you. It's an excellent way as the PLL moves towards these full-time home markets to start building that connection and shaking those hands in that home city, in that home market. These are the folks who are going to be in the stands that you're asking to buy tickets when the Cannons are playing their home games. Getting in front of them this way, connecting with the coaches, with the program leaders, all those folks, it's a great idea. It's a great thing to be doing. So I thought the way that Coach Holman kind of blended in championship culture building and coaching styles and philosophy and all that, with also saying, this is what you can expect from us, the Cannons, a team that's building a championship culture, and we're doing it to play in front of you. And we want to meet you. We want to get to know you. It's a very cool thing to do. Anyway, it was a great event. The whole convention was a great event. There were a few folks who were nice enough to say hello to me, which I always find to be wonderful. If you said hello to me, thanks so much for doing so. I did enjoy every conversation I had. I can be a little socially awkward, but thank you so much for talking to me if you did. Especially to Jerry, who was there to save the face-off, and I believe he did exactly that. Way to go, Jerry. That is going to be it for today. We'll be back on Friday to preview the weekend slate before most of the rest of the college world is getting into action, as does most of D2 and D3. It's all picking up. We've got some more great NLL games this weekend. I am very excited to head out to Long Island to see the Seals come to town on Marvel Night with a City Lax event. There's a if you're picking one Riptide game to go to in the course of the year, it should be this one. Should be good. Thank you again for sticking around with me today, though, and we will see you next time.